Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world on the web at Hewlett.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera, under the musical direction of Ian Hobson, presenting Bach's Complete Brandenburg Concertos on Saturday, November 8th at 7:30 p.m. at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. More information is available at 333-6280.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for joining us today. What does the future hold for children with disabilities when parents are no longer there to provide? Planning for that day is very important. On the program today, we're going to talk about making sure that supports are in place. Our guests are attorney Carl Weber of Urbana and Mary Ann Williams of the ARC, an advocacy organization for persons with disabilities. Mary Ann Williams is a support coordinator with the ARC of Frederick County, Maryland. ARC stands for Advocacy, Resources, and Connections. ARC is a national organization with chapters throughout the country. Mary Ann Williams works with families and individuals, providing them with information about the need for planning and how to go about it. Carl Weber is with Weber & Thies, PC Urbana. Among the things we'll be talking with him about this afternoon are legal tools useful in special needs planning in Illinois. This is a very complicated topic, so if you or your family are in need of financial advice or legal advice or information about state and community supports, you would be wise to use our discussion today as background information or a jumping-off point. We do, though, encourage you to call with questions and comments. Perhaps you have an experience you'd like to share with us. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-9455. W-I-L-L. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-W-I-L-L. Mary Ann Williams, good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon, and I'm happy to be here. Thank you, Celeste.
You're very welcome. And Carl Weber of Urbana, he is here in the studio with me this afternoon. Welcome. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Hi. Well, Mary Ann Williams, I mentioned the ARC is an advocacy group for people with disabilities. Would you tell us, though, a little bit more about the group?
Sure. It started here in Frederick 50 years ago with a group of parents of children who had disabilities. And at that time, there were very few services for children available with disabilities. At that time, most children were sent away to institutions for the rest of their life. And these were parents who were very concerned about that, wanted to keep their children at home. And they began meeting. They formed a committee that actually started the first special education school here in Frederick County. And through the years, they have seen their children grow up and become adults and have continued to support them and find ways to support not only their own families but other families who have individuals with disabilities. So after 50 years, we are a national organization that works with people and serves them in very many different ways, from advocacy for education and independent living all the way through to providing direct services for them.
Yeah. And now here, I'd like to ask you both this question. Please offer us your thoughts on the need for what we call futures planning or special needs planning. Carl Weber, why don't you begin on that one?
The need is enormous. There are a number of different reasons for that. And the biggest reason is the problem that every parent fears, and that is outliving your child who has disabilities. Some people are able to manage taking care of that child during their life. Most people need assistance in doing that, and others are not. But in any case, if you don't set up a system that will take over after you're gone, the child will definitely suffer because there are very numerous problems that can occur, and the kind of program that the ARC presents is a wonderful opportunity for people to learn about what can be done, what benefits they have, and combine that with the possibility for legal planning and financial planning. The two combined together are really what everyone in this situation has to consider.
Hmm. Marianne?
Well, and Carl is exactly right. Legal and financial planning are two really important pieces. But there's another thing that we also encourage parents to think about as they come to this planning, and that's that every parent does so many things automatically for their child who has a disability without even thinking about it. Things such as, my child likes to have his teeth brushed with warm water rather than cold water. If somebody else were to move into the caretaking position and not know that, they might meet with a lot of resistance from that individual when they present them with cold water for brushing their teeth, the foods they like to have, the kind of clothing they like to wear, the activities they enjoy, who would help them at holiday times and for special celebrations like birthdays. All of those kinds of things are also considerations that need to be put in place so that that individual will have a comfortable life when the parent is no longer there to take care of them.
Yeah, and this can be taken care of to some extent in what's known as a letter of intent. And in the ARCS package that they have available for people who are going through this process of planning, there's a lot of information on letters of intent and what it is and why you should write this document. And that what Marianne was just talking about there is some of the things that can go into a letter of intent. So I guess this would be a document you'd want to have as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And might this be a good place to begin to kind of think about what your vision is, what your child's needs are, what your vision for their life is, should you not be there at some point?
That's exactly where we start. When I sit down with a family to start talking about the future planning, that's exactly where I begin with them. Let's look at what would be the ideal living situation. If you had a choice for your child, where would you prefer that they live? And for some families, it's right in the home where they've been all their lives. That helps them focus on the ideas of what are the financial and legal considerations that need to be taken into account in order to make that possible. We also look at recreation. We look at spiritual needs, all the different facets of a person's life. And we do that on a rather informal basis first. And then we say, okay, let's take this information and let's gather it together. Let's organize it into a letter of intent. In the packet of information which we have available, there is one template for a letter of intent. If you go to our website, there's another even more complete letter of intent template that a family could use to start this planning. And it serves not only as a tool for helping the parents plan financial and legal needs for their child and the social needs, but then after the parents are gone, it can serve as a guide map for those who are left to take care of the child.
Hmm. In whose hands should this document be?
We recommend that it be kept with your will so that at the time of a parent's passing, it is readily available. We also recommend that one be kept at home and with anyone who is going to be helping with that child's care in the future. If there's a relative who's going to be helping with holidays, they should have a copy of the letter of intent. If there's somebody who's going to be helping with spiritual life, that person should have a copy of it. The support coordinators or the service coordinators or social workers who work with this individual should have a copy of the letter of intent. Mm. In fact, anybody who is involved in that child's life would do well to have a copy of it.
Mm. And I would imagine also that for some children, whether they're on the young side or whether they're grown, they might be able to play a role in drafting this letter of intent, correct?
Absolutely. We encourage parents to involve as many people as possible in putting together the letter of intent. The more people you have involved, the more complete it will be and the more accurate it will be. And certainly a very important person is the individual who will be served by the letter of intent. It may be that, you know, mother is always dressed the little girl in blue dresses, and she looks at her and says, but I always wanted red. And so that can go into there. Yeah. You know, those kinds of things can come up at any time. And one of the more important things is to say to that child, okay, where would you like to spend your holidays? If you have a holiday coming up, which family member would you prefer to be with? What is your goal for what you want to do as an adult? Or now that you are an adult, do you have any goals for education or for a job or for other employment that you would like to have put onto this letter of intent so that we can start planning for it? They are absolutely essential to helping to plan as soon as they are able to express their desires and needs.
Hmm. Carl Weber, when is the time to begin this process, this planning?
Some would say that you can incorporate in all or any of your estate planning and financial planning documents provisions that can address the issue of a disabled child, even if you have none. Issues that can be addressed in a will because the person has no idea whether their child will be living upon their death and whether the child who may not be living would have a child with a disability. So if you say, when do you start, mm-hmm. you can start much earlier and much broader than many people would think. But obviously, a more direct answer is when you know that there's a disabled person involved in your family. And in the old days, not too long ago, about the only thing people could do would simply be to disinherit the disabled person and make sure that by doing that they didn't have any money and they would therefore get any public funds and public assistance that they might be able to obtain. Another alternative, which probably is somewhat better, is to ask other family members to assist in taking care of the funds and also the person who finds themselves to be disabled. There are a number of reasons why that isn't so good, and I go through them because it kind of leads one to the suggestion of a special needs trust. So why not just give it to the son? If you have a daughter who has difficulties, the son's in the business world and knows how to manage funds. Well, if you rely on the moral obligation of family members, that's not always going to be there forever. It's subject to the debts of the person to whom you give it because you have to give it to them entirely. You can't give it to them in a trust unless you do it the way I'll mention in a minute. The recipient might have the best of intentions but dips into it with the thought that they'll fill it up again, but it doesn't get filled up. Funds being placed in a joint account with the recipient and a spouse might find that they are considered marital property in a divorce proceeding. To say nothing of the death or incompetence or inability of the recipient, then there's no clear successor. So we have a goal of trying to benefit this. We'll speak for the moment as if we're talking primarily about a child. This child with things that are needed. As the child grows up, there are certain benefits that are available, and those benefits are not available if the child, or then the adult, has very much money at all. A bank account over $2,000 pretty much precludes a large amount, a large percentage of the possible benefits. So how do you manage to assure that this person is going to receive the kind of benefits that he or she needs and at the same time try to assist in those benefits in a way that will provide that person additional help over and above the very modest amount that the state might give? The answer is a special needs trust, which can be carefully drafted in order to provide for items over and above that which the state provides. And there are several types of third-party, several types of trusts, third-party trusts and trusts that are begun by the individual, him or herself, called self-settled trusts. But whether it's a third-party trust or a self-settled trust, the concept is to try to protect the funds for use to assist this disabled person beyond that which is provided by the state, and at the same time to assure that they receive that which is coming to them as a benefit from the state.
Yeah, Marianne Williams, you know, one very important issue is one that Carl has raised here, the restriction on assets an individual can own while receiving some public benefits. From your point of view, would you maybe expand on that and tell us what you've encountered and maybe follow up on what Carl Weber has just talked about here?
Certainly. The limit of assets for example, one of the main benefits that many people receive is supplemental security income. And under the law, the maximum amount of assets a person can have is $2,000. If they have more than $2,000 in a bank account or in accumulated assets at any time, they lose that SSI benefit. What that does is it takes away several hundred dollars per month for that person. I was talking with a family a few weeks ago where the parents had failed to put into plan a trust, and the child inherited $75,000 in assets. The parents felt that $75,000 was quite a bit of money, and it would be for most people because you would invest it and then you would live off of the benefits from that. However, this person with a disability, not long after he received that $75,000, lost his SSI payments and then required some additional work to be done in his house in order to make it possible for him to remain in the house. He used $73,000 of that trust, and the money was gone. If he had not had access to those assets, they could have been used differently. The housing could have been taken care of differently, and he would have still had a sizable amount of his assets to continue to live on through the remainder of his life. It has a tremendous impact on people when they can only have $2,000 worth of bankable assets to use to augment what they receive from the state. And the state is really only trying to prevent people from living in dire poverty. They want to make sure they have a home and they have food, and to a certain extent, some clothing. And as we all know, most of us like to have something a little more than home and food and minimal amounts of clothing. So when you take $2,000 and say that's as much as you can possibly own, that's not a lot to provide for all of the other things that somebody else can have for the rest of their life. It has a tremendous impact on families. The trust enables people to continue that quality of life. They can have a pet. They can have physical therapy. They can join a gym. They can continue on holidays, going on vacation trips, and doing things like that that would not be covered if all they had was the state benefit. And so it has a tremendous impact on people to have that trust in place.
And, of course, in addition, there are a number of benefits that are available only if you're receiving SSI. So
exactly.
If you have too much money in your account and you're in a group home that may be, what should I say, $60,000 to $100,000 a year in value,
mm-hmm.
And you lose the SSI, you can lose that home. And these are the people in our society who can do for themselves the least.
Right.
And we have tried to do something for them, Unfortunately, Illinois is, I think, 48th out of 50. Thank goodness for Arkansas and I think something else. In the amount of benefits we provide for those with disabilities, but making it even more important in Illinois that one does take care to receive that which is available.
Right. And one of the big benefits that's frequently tied directly to SSI is Medicaid,
yes,
medical assistance. And when you take a person who inherits a great deal of money, and it seems like a wealth, $125,000, and within a few months they need major surgery, and they're not receiving medical assistance any longer, all of that money can be used up in that medical care. And then they're put down into that very limited lifestyle that depends only on public support. And so that's a huge consideration. When I speak with families about assets for their children, one of the things I always emphasize to them is if they're receiving medical assistance, they need to really think about the cost of that and how that benefits their child without having to dip into their own pockets.
Mm. Well, let me give you a hypothetical here. Just, I'm a little confused. Now, what if I left, let's say in my will I had a provision for someone in my family who had a disability, and I had no idea about anything like this. Is there a way for the person with the disability to say, no, Aunt Celeste, thank you very much, but I will not accept the amount of money that you provided for me in my will, your will?
No, they cannot.
They can't?
They can spend it down, and at some time in the future, when it's spent as SSI will allow it to be spent, then they're back and can apply again. Mm-hmm. But between that time, mm-hmm, they may have lost enormous benefits, whether we're talking about Medicaid or some housing, get back on the bottom of the list. It can just be frightening. One of the standard letters that is usually sent out when someone puts together a special needs trust is a letter to all of the family members who might possibly consider the disabled person to be one of the people who might either be a direct or a contingent beneficiary of savings accounts, life insurance policies, or a will itself, or a living will, asking those people to please adjust the wording so that it directs the funds to that special needs trust, or it places it in a protective situation.
And there's one other thing that the individual could probably do, and Carl, you could probably explain this very well, and that's to do a self-settled trust.
Yes. You can, if the person has received this amount of money, you can indeed do a self-settled trust where they basically make the trust themselves, but there is the requirement then that upon their death, if there's any money left in it, it must pay all of the various states' Medicare back throughout their entire life. This, on the one hand, you say, well, they got the benefit. Why can't they pay it back? On the other hand, I think people have a tendency, if they possibly can, to overfund the various trusts that might be there because they don't know how much is going to be needed, with the assumption that upon the passing of the disabled person, it'll go to the other members of the family. So that overfunding can then come back and be gone.
Hmm.
Maybe, and you may have a better, another or an additional comment about the self-settled trust as well.
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. The self-settled trust can enable the person with a disability to use those assets during a lifetime, so they do continue to receive the state benefits while at the same time taking advantage of an elevated lifestyle through the funds in the trust. The big problem is at the end of that person's life when Medicaid comes in and retrieves the amount of money that they have spent. It's not the preferred method of doing it. We prefer that people plan ahead and leave money into a third-party trust. But if the need comes, it is a way of doing it so that gifted person can have a better lifestyle than just depending upon the state benefits to maintain what he can. There's not a perfect solution when the person inherits money directly or receives any assets directly. But that's a better solution than even a spend-down solution or just hoping that everything's going to work out.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our topic this afternoon is special needs planning. What does the future hold for children, young or adult, with disabilities when parents or guardians are no longer there to provide? What we're talking about this afternoon is planning for that time. Our guests are attorney Carl Weber of Urbana and Marianne Williams of the ARC, which is an advocacy organization for persons with disabilities. Marianne Williams is a support coordinator with the ARC of Frederick County, Maryland. ARC stands for Advocacy, Resources, and Connections. It's a national organization with chapters throughout the country. There are many in the state of Illinois. Marianne Williams works with families and individuals, providing them with information about the need for planning and how to go about it. Carl Weber with me in the studio this afternoon is with Weber and Thies PC Urbana. And among the things, of course, we're talking with him this afternoon, the legal tools useful in special needs planning in Illinois, including special needs trusts, two varieties of them, third-party trusts and self-settled trusts. Listeners, if you have a question, a comment, if you have an experience you'd like to share with us this afternoon, give us a call. Join us. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, let's back up a little bit now. We talked about, at the outset, we talked about a letter of intent as a way to start focusing on what the needs are and what your vision is, what your goals are. Once you've kind of got that in view, what happens next? How do you start to sort through these issues?
Well, the thing I suggest to parents first after they do their ideal situation is to say, let's take an example. You want your child to remain in the home where he grew up all of his life. And I use the he just as a generic pronoun. It could be a girl as well. Once you have that down, what are the legal steps that you need to take to make sure that that house can remain in the child's possession? And what are the financial arrangements that need to be done so the child can remain in the home? What are the practical implications of that decision or of that wish? Will the child need a caretaker to stay at home with them? Is there another family member who's willing to do that? And that's when you begin to call upon people in the community within your range of family, with neighbors, and you ask them, are you willing to help in this area? And you try and pull as many connections together as you can. The more people you have working together to help this child, the better that child's life will be. So that you try to get neighbors involved, church members involved, community members involved, as many as you possibly can. The other piece of that is that if you ask one person, for example, a sibling, to care for that child for the rest of his life, that he may eventually say, this is not fair to me. I have my own life to live, and I'm spending most of my time taking care of my child or my sibling with a disability. But instead, if you ask the sibling to do the finances, and perhaps a cousin would do the birthday celebration, and perhaps a neighbor would take him bowling, and so forth, so that each person has just one thing to do, and it's an occasional thing. That's often much easier to arrange. And once you have all of that in place, then you need to look at the legal and the financial steps to make it possible for all of this to happen. And that's when we say, it's time to talk to an attorney so that you can make up a will and you can make up a supplemental special needs trust that will enact all of these things. And also to talk to a financial advisor who can give you some suggestions on how to use your investments to make that trust feasible.
Mm. And when does the family physician come in to the picture as well? I would think that medical planning might be an issue as well.
It always is. Yeah.
The concept of Medicaid and Medicare are both very complicated and very, very important. It's like gold. It's This is a planning concept that's different than usual. Usually someone comes in and the first thing you say is, well, if you were to die tomorrow, count up how much your assets would be, include your life insurance and your other amounts. What would the total be? And you calculate in your head to determine whether or not there's any risk for federal estate tax. And then if there's not, it goes on fairly smoothly. Here, even the most modest folks need a will, because if they don't have a will, they'll have funds going to their children whether they want it to or not. And that can cause the problem that we were just talking about a minute ago. I think Mary Ann's approach to having various people assist in care is a wonderful approach. You have to assume that there is some place where they're living, however, and they have to have the funds or the funding to be someplace. I mean, it's one thing to go to a niece or a nephew or a family friend and say, can I put you down as the guardian of my daughter, who's now 5 and I'm now 40, and the chances of them ever even having to do it is remote at best. It's another to say, would you be the guardian of or the primary person to look after and possibly have live with you my disabled son or daughter? That's a sure thing. And that's a long time process. So the amount of money that you have that will be available has to be absolutely maximized. And the amount of money available and the services available from the state has to be absolutely maximized. Or even under ordinary circumstances, it's just not going to be there. And then what do you do?
Yeah. Let's take a call now. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us this afternoon on line 1 in Bloomington. Good afternoon.
Oh, yeah, hi. I was absolutely staggered to listen to what you said because there are just so many unintended consequences of our current policy. And I just had a question I'd like to ask. It almost sounds as if somebody could maliciously make a small bequest, which, from what you said, can't be refused, and yet would cause serious financial harm to the beneficiary. I mean, somebody, for example, has some bone to pick with the family or wants to get the family through this. Am I wrong? I was just wondering. I'll take my answer off the air.
It's an interesting question. It's never come up, and I hope it never does. But it could indeed cause a problem. Marianne, what do you think?
I have never heard of that situation either, but certainly there is a possibility that it could happen. I would think one of the reasons why someone would think twice about being a malicious donor would be that no matter what their intent is, the individual who receives those assets is going to be able to use them in some way to benefit their life. And so they probably would be not really achieving their purpose if they did that. But again, any bequest that somebody should receive who has a disability, it's important to think about two ways of handling that bequest, and it would depend upon how much they receive. One would be to spend the money in the best way allowable as quickly as possible so they don't lose any of the benefits. Or if they're not able to do that, then to set up a self-settled trust.
So actually, the problem with the self-settled trust of having to give away some of it at the end is kind of spending the house money.
Right.
You wouldn't have had it, so it's this person has allowed you some benefit. I'm not sure, I guess, upon reflection, that they'd probably want to do that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I would assume that if they're going to do this, they would have an attorney help them with it. And the attorney might be able to find that reasoning behind it and dissuade them from doing it.
You'd hope so.
We hope so.
The things provided for in the trust, Carl, you've mentioned maximizing. What are the strategies for maximizing what you've got?
The proper trustee and the proper method of investing, so that you have your best opportunity to receive a maximum return. There are various ways to do that, and I think Marianne's organization, do you have a pooled trust, Marianne?
Not in the ARC, we don't. Ah. There are some pooled trusts in our area, but the ARC does not have one.
But you can do a what's called a pooled trust under some circumstances where it's a group where you pool it and have then some people who have quite a bit of ability in investing, and if it's a modest amount, you can put it in an account where you get take advantage of having someone with that quality. Also, even in the third-party trusts, you can there are some funds that you can join and join together. But you say, how can we maximize it? It can be maximized by the trustee spending it for the right things and not for the wrong things, not falling for the disabled person wanting, even though it's possibly allowed, something that they shouldn't be receiving because it's just not feasible with the amount of money they have, keeping the investment return as high as you can, and making sure that they don't stub their toe and lose their benefits because of commingling funds in a way that would cause that loss.
So how do you select a trustee?
Carefully.
Yeah, the word trustee is really key to this. Trustee has to be someone whom you trust to take the best interest of the child with a disability, even if it's an adult child, but to take that interest first. And it is by far the number one question I hear when I talk with families. Who do I choose for a trustee? And I can't tell them who to choose. It has to come from your own experience, whom you trust. One of the questions I ask them is, if your child were not an adult, who would you trust for your child to go and live with? That might be the person you want to ask if they would be a trustee.
In many cases, you try to find You may combine them as a co-trustee with an organization that is very familiar with these kinds of rules. Otherwise, even the best of people with the best of intent may not know everything they need to know about the complexities of these situations, and just accidentally commingle or put the wrong thing in the wrong place or use money for the wrong thing. So in many cases, it would be a family member with perhaps a corporate trustee that's familiar with this kind of this kind of trust.
Okay, corporate trustee. Talk a little bit about that. What's a corporate trustee?
Could be a bank.
Okay.
And there are specific organizations that are set up to do that. In Illinois, there is a system under the pooled trust system of the self trust where there is a pool and there's a corporate trustee and you work with both, and that can be helpful. Go ahead.
One of the things that I agree with you, Carl, and your suggestion is absolutely perfect. One of the things that we tell people is that if you choose only a corporate trustee, a business that is organized specifically to handle trusts for people, they may not know the child or the individual with a disability well enough to know that this is a person who has always wanted to go see the Grand Canyon. So when he asks to go see the Grand Canyon, the corporate trustee may say, no, that's not a worthwhile expense. We're not going to spend that kind of money for you to go and see the Grand Canyon. On the other hand, if you have just a family person as a trustee, they may say, oh, I know you've always wanted to go see the Grand Canyon, so we'll go see it every year for the next 15 years. And so, you know, both of them are doing what they think is right from their point of view, but it's not necessarily the best thing from both points of view.
That's a good example.
So by putting them together, they can make a wise decision. One will know the individual, the other will know the financial aspect.
Yeah. Now, if let's just say hypothetically, I'm serving as a trustee, and I need help, but I feel a little uncomfortable with taking on my family the burden of going to an attorney or to an accountant or what have you, is there room for lifting that off the shoulders of a trustee?
That's one of the advantages of having a trust,
okay,
in that one of the expenses that's legitimately allowed is the expense of advocacy. So hopefully you can have not only legal and possibly accounting advice, but also advice from someone who knows what plans are available. Where should I be? What should I be applying for? I just found out today I should have my daughter's name on a list, and I didn't even know about the list. I just happened to be calling, checking on things for today. And at the Regional Plan Commission, she should be on a list, and she will be in about a week. So thank you for asking me to come.
Great.
But it seems like the list is never ending, and the challenges and the different options and alternatives are so broad, and the exceptions are so many that it really does take someone who knows what they're talking about to be able to tell you just what rights your child has. It's very complicated, to say nothing of the complications of drafting and deciding what kind of trust paragraphs to use. You can talk an hour about each one of the paragraphs to make sure that you do it right. It's just a very complicated issue.
And so one of the things that, another question that many parents ask me is, can I go to a business supply store or can I go to the Internet and pull down a template for a trust or pull down a template for a will? And at the ARC, we recommend that they do not do that, that they go and see an attorney, because it does have to have particular specific language to make it valid. And there are so many crooks and turns that have to be in there that wouldn't be there in a generic trust or in a generic will. And so despite the expense of having an attorney, it pays off in the end to go and see an attorney.
And we all,
get it done right.
We all have some real horror stories about the template case. And one of the recent continuing education courses I attended, they spent almost 2 hours discussing what changes you make sure you make to the template, and how is one going to know even whether the template is for a third-party trust or a self-settled trust, and a D4A trust or a D4C trust. It's just you can't expect that knowledge on the part of someone who's casually trying to draft the document.
Hmm. Now, Marianne, in the materials that I have from the ARC of Frederick County, Maryland, there is a pamphlet called Five Wishes,
mm-hmm.
My Wish For.
Yes.
And then this is kind of a template thing. What's the value of a document like this? And I don't know if it would be a legally binding document?
It is not a legal document, but it is honored in most of the states of the United States. And at the front of it, it does have a list of every state in the United States that does honor it.
Illinois is there.
Indiana is also there.
It is?
I believe so.
I don't see it here.
Oh, well, I may be mistaken.
Yeah, Indiana. And I want to make that clear because we do have listeners in
right.
Indiana. So it's Idaho, Illinois, and Iowa are the I states.
Okay. So it would not be honored in Indiana. Most people are familiar with the term a living will. And basically, Five Wishes is a form of a living will, although it has some pieces to it that are not included necessarily in the living will. The reason why we have this document is primarily because if you go to a doctor and they give you a living will to fill out, it's written in language that is so full of technical terms that it's difficult for the average person to really understand what they're agreeing to have done or not done. We wanted to put together a document that someone with limited ability or less technical ability could understand easily. And so that's why the Five Wishes is there. Now, if you look at the Five Wishes document, it's several pages long, and the reason for that is because it is divided into five different areas of a person's life in terms of medical treatment. It's an advanced medical directive. And I frequently recommend not only for adults who have disabilities, but for their parents to have one of these done if they don't have a living will. The reason I suggest it is because I imagine the situation of a parent who is taken to the hospital in a comatose situation, as an example. And the doctor needs to have direction of how to treat the parent. And so you're working with a child, an adult child of limited abilities, trying to make medical decisions while they're dealing with the emotional feelings coming about by having a parent who has become disabled. And I feel that that would be overwhelming for someone who is struggling. The Five Wishes document makes it possible to tell ahead of time the medical community what kinds of care you would like to have in a life-threatening or an end-of-life situation so that it doesn't devolve to that child to make the decisions. In addition, for a child who does have disabilities or an adult who has disabilities, it's written in language that's simple enough that they can indeed understand what they're agreeing to.
It's a very humane
document. It's a wonderful document. It really is. And it goes well beyond just, I want artificial feeding at the end of my life. It goes into things such as what I'd like my friends and family to know when I die. Things like, I forgive them for any time they've hurt me. I want them to know that I've loved them all of my life. It talks about those kinds of things as well. And also it talks about if you are at an end stage of life, what would you like to have around you, and who would you like to have around you? Do you want to have a spiritual advisor there? Do you want to have soft music playing in the background? Do you want to have your feet rubbed? Those kinds of things that would make you more comfortable as you reach the end of your life. And it's not typically on a living will document.
But also now here I'm going to ask one more question, and it goes to the attorney, and that is, there are other documents, of course, that also people would want to have or be thinking about, planning for a living will, a will, power of attorney, power of healthcare attorney. Those kinds of things are also going to be playing into this whole special needs planning picture.
Yes, there's quite a list. You've done a great job of listing a good number of them. But with special needs, as I mentioned, the letter to the relatives. There's quite a list of documents that are just standardly done as you go through the process.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Carl Weber, thank you very much.
Thank
Mary
you.
Ann Williams, thank you.
My pleasure.
Mary Ann Williams is a support coordinator with the ARC of Frederick County, Maryland. The acronym ARC stands for Advocacy, Resources, and Connections. Carl Weber is with Weber and Thies, PC, Urbana. And by the way, from our website, will.illinois.edu, you can go to the afternoon magazine to today's show, and there's a link to the ARC of Frederick County, Maryland. But you can get there just by putting it into your browser. Again, a big thank you to our guests this afternoon, Carl Weber and Mary Ann Williams. It's 1:54. Settlement prices should be in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here with all the numbers, Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. Let's take a look at those numbers, Celeste, as they settled on a Thursday afternoon in Chicago at the Board of Trade. The soft red winter wheat today lost 23¼ cents, had a high price of $5.78.5 a bushel. The low at 530.5 and a settlement price at 538, down 23¼. March 598, the high, the low at 550¾, settlement price at 558¾, down 22½ in the May futures in the wheat pit. 608, the high, the low at 564¾, settlement price at 572¼, down 22¾. July futures, 624½, the high, the low at 78. Settlement price at $5.85¾, down 22½ cents. And next year's December wheat, $6.25, settlement price down 20¾. December corn futures in Chicago, $4.33, the high. The low at $4.02¼, settlement price at $4.09½, down 11¼ cents today. Although when I'm looking at that market on the week, it appears that we're up 36¾ at this point from last Friday. That means that we have an outside up week. As a done deal at this point in December corn. So we'll talk more about that and make sure that I'm right with Dan Zwicker during the closing market report this afternoon. See just how friendly that might make the marketplace. 450 was the high in the March contract for the corn on the day, the low at 420. Settlement price at 427.5, down 10.75. And May, 462.25, the high, the low at 32. Settlement price at $4.39.5, down 10.5 points or cents. July futures, 472.25, the high, the low at 442. Settlement price there at 450, down 10.75. And September corn settled a dime lower, 475 the high, a low at 52.75. Settlement price at $4.59.5, down 10 cents on the day. December oats at 239.5, settlement price unchanged. March a quarter higher at 257. And one quarter soy complex now. November beans, 964 the high, the low at 18.5. Settlement price at $9.34, down 3.25. January futures, 974 the high, the low at 27.25. Settlement price at $9.43, down 4 cents in the March, 984.75, the high, the low at 940.25. Settlement price at 955, down 4.25. May futures, 995, the high, the low at 51.5. A settlement price at $9.65.75, down 3.75. July futures in the soybean pit, $10.75, the high, the low at 960.25. Settlement price at 974.75, down 2.75. And next year's November beans gained a penny and a half today, 995.25, the high, the low at 56.25. Settlement price for November 2009 soybeans, $9.72, up 1.5 cents for the day. December bean meal futures, 288.90, the high, the low at 77.80. Settlement price at $283.30, up 30 cents. January at 284.50 for the bean meal, down 80 cents. December soybean oil, 35.24, the high, the low at 33.32, settled at 34.48, 15 higher than January's at 34.97, a dime higher on the day. I'll return at 6 after the hour of 2 with the closing market report. I'm Todd Gleason.
WILL programs are made possible by the iCorn.com Seeds of Knowledge Video Scholarship Contest. Farmers nominate students who make a 90-second video and compete for a share of $30,000 in college scholarships from iCorn.com. More information is available online at iCorn.com.
Now let's take a look at settlement prices from Chicago. From the Merck today, livestock contracts. October live cattle, the high, 94.20. The settlement, 92.10. The low, 92.10. The settlement, 93.50. Hope that came out correctly now. The change, the difference, up 185. October live cattle. December, 92.65. The high, 91.15. The low, 91.45. The settlement, that up 45. February, 94. Even the high, 92.70. The low, the settlement, 93.25. That up 72.5. April, 94.70. The high, the low, 93.40. The settlement, 93.70. That up 50. October feeder cattle, 96.20. The high, 96.05. The low, the settlement, 96.07.5. That finishing up 27.5. November, 98.35, the high, 96.75, the low, 97.85, the settlement, that up 135. January, 97.80, the high, 96.15, the low, 97.25, the settlement, that up 135. March, 98.20, the high, 96.50, the low, 97.75, the settlement, that up 125. December lean hogs, 56.95, the high, 55.95, the low, 56 even, the settlement, that down 157.5. February, 63.95, the high, 63.20, the low, 63.42.5, the settlement, that down 90. April, 70.15, the high, 69.60, the low, 70 even, the settlement, that down 47.5. May, 77.95, the high, 77.20, the low, 77.92.5, the settlement, that down 32.5. And February, pork bellies, 88.90, the high, 86.40, the low, the settlement, 86.75, that down 62.5. The Dow currently up 158 at 91.49, the NASDAQ up 39 at 16.96, the S&P 500 up 21 at 9.51, the price is